From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My take currently is that what you have been intense negotiations to try to save the FTAA, but what we have is apparently an agreement that will be basically quite hollow.
Democracy Now! Goes to Miami, where thousands of protesters are staging demonstrations outside the negotiations meeting for the free trade area of the Americas. A part of Miami is locked down. Attorney General John Ashcroft files fresh charges against civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. And an update on the independent 911 Commission's investigation into what happened on September 11th. We'll be joined by Peter Lance, author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, and Monica Gabrielle, who lost her husband Richard in the attacks.
We're interested in full disclosure of everything that's pertinent to 9/11.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. These are the headlines. In Istanbul, at least 25 people have died. Nearly 400 are injured after two near simultaneous suicide bombs exploded outside the British consulate and the HSBC Bank headquarters. This comes days after 25 others died in another bombing in Istanbul that targeted two synagogues. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said, quote, "I'm afraid it's all the hallmarks of international terrorism practiced by Al-Qaeda." On Tuesday, Turkish officials revealed two Turks were behind the weekend bombings. Turkey is one of Washington's closest political and military allies in the Muslim world. Meanwhile, in southeastern Turkey, the Turkish military killed 12 members of the Kurdish resistance on Wednesday. On Capitol Hill, the House and Senate took a major step last night by including a measure in the $284 billion omnibus spending bill that would block the implementation of the FCC new rules regulating media ownership. By including the provision in a major spending bill, it sets up a potential battle with the White House, which has vowed to veto any effort to roll back the media ownership laws. But now President Bush can only do that by vetoing the entire spending bill. In another setback to President Bush, lawmakers prevented an effort by House Speaker Dennis Hastert and Majority Leader Tom DeLay to include a provision within the spending bill that would have allowed the nation's overtime laws to be rewritten. Up to 8 million working Americans could have lost overtime pay. In other news from Capitol Hill, congressional negotiators approved a controversial measure that will grant the FBI greater power to seize private business records without the approval of a judge or grand jury in cases considered related to terrorism. Six members of the Senate Judiciary Committee protested the inclusion of the new powers in the intelligence spending bill because the committee had yet to hold public hearings or public debate on the matter. A series of attacks in Iraq have targeted and killed Iraqis who have worked closely with the U.S. In Basra, a pro-U.S. politician was assassinated. In Kirkuk, four people died after a bomb exploded outside the offices of the pro-U.S. Union of Kurdistan political party. And in Ramadi, a car bomb exploded, killing two outside the home of a Sunni tribal leader with close ties to the United States. The Guardian of London is reporting Pentagon advisor Richard Perle has admitted the invasion of Iraq was illegal. Perle, who is a strong backer of the invasion, told an audience in London, quote, "I think in this case international law stood in the way of doing the right thing." He added, quote, International law would have required us to leave Saddam Hussein alone. The backlash against AARP's support for President Bush's proposed overhaul of the Medicare system continued on Wednesday. In Washington, about two dozen AARP members from Maryland, New York, and Pennsylvania rallied outside the organization's Washington headquarters to cut up their membership cards. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports the AARP's support for the measure came after years of courtship by President Bush and congressional Republican leaders. The Pentagon said Wednesday a 22-year-old Army medic may have died as a result of receiving vaccinations, including ones for anthrax and smallpox. In Zimbabwe, the leading unions have called for a two-day strike in response to the arrest of up to 360 anti-government protesters. The International Atomic Energy Agency now believes Russia, China, and Pakistan likely supplied Iran with technology that allowed Iran to enrich uranium, possibly as part of a nuclear program. And in London, up to 100,000 people are expected to march today to protest President Bush's visit to Britain. Just before the program, Democracy Now! Reached British Member of Parliament George Galloway.
This is the British people in their tens, if not hundreds of thousands, saying that we don't want this foolish, ignorant, and dangerous man in our country. And the fact that we're led by an American, Ron Kovic, born on the 4th of July and a real American hero, a man who spent 35 years in a wheelchair for patriotism, shows that there's nothing anti-American about our demonstration or our anti-war movement. We love the people of America. We just despise the fool who stole the election to become their president. Obviously, we don't want anything to happen to George Bush, not least because Dick Cheney is next in line. We have no problem about them taking whatever measures they need to protect the safety of the American president. But we were concerned that we were going to be blocked from exercising our democratic rights to protest just exactly in his lair. But the police showed greater wisdom than our own government did on this occasion. And I'm glad to say this afternoon we'll be going through the traditional marching grounds of the British people.
Former Labour Party Member of Parliament George Galloway was kicked out of the Labour Party, is now forming a new one based on the anti-war movement in Britain. You are listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country, Amy. Well, it looks like the Congress has moved on this FCC matter after all. And I guess Rupert Murdoch is worried now because obviously the Fox Network was one of the ones that wanted to expand beyond 35% of the television audiences around the country to 45%. And we'll have to see now whether President Bush actually goes against his own Republicans and Democrats in Congress, a remarkable bipartisan unity around the issue that the mass media have gotten too big and too powerful and cannot be permitted to continue to concentrate ownership.
It's really quite amazing, Juan, when you look at the spectrum of groups that targeted Congress when it came to the FCC launching the largest media consolidation in history with the change of their rules. Everyone from the National Rifle Association to the feminist anti-war group Code Pink said no. And we see the effects now in Congress and the Senate.
Yes, remarkable unity on both Republicans and Democrats. And as I've mentioned before, a lot of Republican senators in small states are sick and tired of the national media determining how they're going to be able to continue in office, raising all this money just to give it to television in ads. And they're rebelling against these major media companies who were accustomed to having all these decisions made behind closed door in the FCC without any kind of public input at all.
Well, we're going to turn right now to Britain. Following up on George Galloway's interview, we're going to the streets. Thousands of people are in the streets right now in Britain. Carol Turner is with us from the Stop the War Coalition. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carol.
Hello, and thank you for calling us.
Can you tell us where you are and what's happening?
Well, I'm at the head of the demonstration, which is already forming up, several thousand people an hour in advance of marching off. And all the signs are it's going to be a very big demonstration.
Can you talk about what's going to be happening?
Yes, we're going to march along a central London route that we've chosen. I'm very pleased to say Scotland Yard have been cooperative and have finally agreed with us that it's the best route to take. That means we're going to be marching to Parliament and down Whitehall, past Downing Street, which, you know, is the residence of the Prime Minister.
And the reaction of those in the anti-war movement to President Bush's speech?
Well, there's not much sympathy for George Bush over here. And I'm not just talking about the protesters who've taken to the streets. I'm also talking about a very broad spread of British opinion. People don't feel that the policies of the American government are bringing peace. On the contrary, they think that it's making the world a far less safe place. They also feel extremely disturbed at the idea that American policy is dictating the policy of Tony Blair and the British government.
I'm reading from the front page of the Washington Post today. It says President Bush presented a spirited defense of the war in Iraq Wednesday, telling European critics on the first official day of a state visit to Britain that the use of force was justified as a last resort to protect freedom. He said the people have given us the duty to defend them, and that duty sometimes requires the violent restraint of violent men. Your response, Carol Turner.
Well, people don't believe the war on Iraq is justified. We were told that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. This has turned out to be lies. The two governments with the most weapons of mass destruction are the United States and Britain with a nuclear arsenal. People no longer are convinced of that case. Furthermore, having watched for the last 6 months American and British soldiers dying in Iraq because the population see them as an occupying army, they're not convinced of the strategy at all.
Well, Carol Turner, we want to thank you very much for being with us from the streets of Britain. Can you talk about the act that we heard will be taking place this afternoon in Trafalgar Square?
Absolutely. This demonstration will arrive at Trafalgar Square at around 4 o'clock, 4:30 our time. And at 5 o'clock our time, we're going to be toppling a statue of George Bush. That's a papier-mâché statue. Will be coming down, and that's part of our rally to end this huge protest. We think it's going to be the biggest working day demonstration in the capital city for about 4 decades.
Carol Turner, thanks very much for being with us. And you
Thank
are listening you. To Democracy Now as we will continue to follow the protest there, President Bush, the first state presidential visit of a U.S. president to Britain. And we now go to Miami. Protests have gotten underway at the Free Trade Area of the Americas Summit in Miami. Several hundred people are marching through the streets of Miami ahead of a much larger demonstration planned for later today that will be attended by some 2,000 steel workers. The protest began this morning at 6:15. We're going to go to Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, who has been in the streets in Miami. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
You know that the $87 billion Iraq bill included some $8 million for the Miami security forces that are deploying streets, more than 40 counties in the state of Florida, sending police into Miami, some 9,000 police on the streets today. There are now more than 1,000 people in front of the government center where the Free Trade of the Americas Summit is getting underway this morning. I am currently on a march with about 350 people who have been surrounded by the police for the last half an hour or so. The police have been taking out tasers as well as tear gas grenades, but there have been no major incidents yet. We are making our way through the streets right now. All of this is coming ahead of the rally that is planned for later today and the march that is going to be led by some 2,000 steel workers.
Jeremy Scahill, reporting to us from Miami One.
And Jeremy, the steel workers are marching around what issue in particular?
Well, the steel workers are saying that they have learned lessons from Seattle. They are very well organized here. And basically what they are saying is that these are mainstream issues. These are working people's issues. To be against the free trade area of the Americas is not a radical cause. It's not a left-wing cause or a right-wing cause, but it's a cause for working people. What they are saying is that the unions are making a major campaign now to oppose the FTAA, NAFTA, and continue to oppose the World Trade Organization. I was talking to a bunch of steel workers last night, and they were talking about how they are going to serve as buffers on this march. They have two concerns, Juan. The first is that they do not want the police to beat people, so they're going to be protecting all of the other people. And as you know, Juan, these are very big guys. It's like having your own tanks in front of our demonstration. But the second issue is they want to prevent the media from portraying this as a bunch of kids with dreadlocks and body piercings in the streets. As I said, they are saying these are working people's issues, mainstream people's issues. What's interesting is as we walk through the streets of Miami, people, local people are coming out of their houses to wave at the demonstrators. It really seems like the public sentiment here on the streets among the residents of Miami is overwhelmingly in support of what the demonstrators are here doing.
Jeremy, thanks very much for being with us. We are going to move on right now to Walden Bellow in Miami, as well as people gather from around the world to protest the FTAA. Walden Bellow, director of Focus on the Global South in Bangkok, Thailand, one of the leaders of the anti-corporate globalization movement, laying out what's at stake in these FTAA meetings.
My take currently is that what you have been intense negotiations to try to save the FTAA, but what we have is apparently an agreement that will be basically quite hollow. And in that sense, because of the fact that you have practically no commitments that have been made by countries except very broad sort of statements and the fact that many of the objections of Brazil and other countries around, for instance, the whole question of investment, the areas of intellectual property rights, that the U.S. basically has not been able to beat down the opposition in those areas. What we have is a face-saving gesture that basically we, the FTAA train is in fact not been derailed, as it were. It's leaving Miami, but it's got 9 very hollow carriages. And in that sense, the fact that the FTAA, has really not managed to get a comprehensive set of sub-agreements binding on member countries, leaving Miami, I think this is a very important victory for the movement. However, my own sense is that's not enough. I think so long as the FTAA framework exists, the U.S. will keep coming back to it. When you have a time that the political situation might be more advantageous for the United States and the political situation is weaker and less, Brazil and others might have a weaker capacity to bargain, then I think you will find the U.S. again, push to get these agreements on investment, intellectual property rights, and others back onto the agenda. So I would say that I think it's important to underline that this is not the FTAA that the United States wanted, but this is so far an incomplete victory for people's movements. We can only really be assured, we can only really have guarantees against the FTAA once as an institution and as an agreement, it's totally scrapped as a goal. So I think the dynamics here is, you know, there is a sense of the United States that they cannot allow Miami to be another Cancun in which we have the complete collapse of a ministerial. So I think they're settling for second best, which is that despite the fact that agreements, negotiations have gotten nowhere, they'll try to paint that it as having some momentum, and that isn't it great that this did not collapse like Cancun? So that's the sort of dynamics that we have here, and I think it would be very important for people, for the movements here, to say that no, the United States has in fact suffered a setback in Miami because it did not get the sort of binding, comprehensive FTAA that it's wanted all along, and that the resistance of many countries under pressure from their civil society movements about defending their national sovereignty and then the capacity of their governments to make sovereign decisions in all of these economic areas, that that has to be pointed out as the major obstacle to the United States, you know, getting what it's wanted. Now the situation is that because precisely it has not it's been stalled on the FTAA, the United States is now going into bilateral deals, and it just announced, you know, that it will be moving into bilateral deals with the Andean countries. Of course, there's the Central America Free Trade Area that's up there. It's, you know, it's negotiating bilateral deals with Thailand and has a number of other things on the agenda. On the one hand, I think that is definitely a threat that, you know, if we have bilateral deals in which you have a weak country and a big imposing country like the United States, that is going to be very bad for weak countries. But at the same time, I think what we ought to note here is that the sort of global multilateral framework or the regional multilateral framework that the United States business preferred, they were not able to get it. And this is why they're moving into bilateral deals. I think that they will not have an easy time getting bilateral deals, especially once they begin to see, you know, how bad the U.S.-Singapore deal is, how bad the U.S.-Chile deal is, how bad the CAFTA is shaping up. So I think that, yes, these bilateral deals are very threatening, but I would say that they're more a sign of weakness rather than strength of the United States. And I think that really has to be pointed out. They are a third best option for a desperate administration.
Walden Bello is director of Focus on the Global South from Bangkok, Thailand, in Miami for the protests against the FTAA. When we come back, we'll hear from Tony Clark of the Council on Canadians, who's gotten some documents that others haven't seen. And then we're going to go to the 911 investigations hearings that took place at Drew University in New Jersey yesterday. Finally, Lynn Stewart will join us. She has been indicted once again by the Justice Department. You are listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
November 30th, 99. History walking on a tightrope line. Big money pulling on invisible strings. Getting into everything so deep. It's hard to believe it's in the food and the water and the air you breathe and the chemistry, the biotech, the banker with the bottomless check, the corporations and the CEOs and the bottom line as the profit grows. The money talks, you don't talk back, they don't like you when you act like that. But didn't we shut it down? November 30th, 1999. It was a Tuesday morning when we drew the line. It was a WTO coming to town, and we swore we're gonna shut it down. And they stood there with their big police. They had the National Guard out to keep the peace, with the guns and the clubs and the chemical gas. But still we would not let them pass. And they raged and roared and their tempers flared, and there were bombs bursting in the daylight air. And they'd run us off and do us in, but we came right back again. Yeah, didn't we? Shut it down, didn't we?
Didn't we? Jim Page here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue on the protests against the free trade area of the Americas in Miami, we're joined by Tony Clark, who is director of the Polaris Institute in Canada with the Council of Canadians. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us, Tony. Can you talk about the document you've gotten your hands on in Miami?
Yeah, well, this is the draft document. Actually, it's pretty close to the final document, I think, that's going to come out of these meetings. What's been going on in the last week, there's been a flurry of activity between the two co-chairs of the FTAA, which is United States and Brazil, or Robert Zoellick and Mr. Amarin, who is the lead minister for Brazil. And they've been as you know, reached a compromise in the sense of a kind of a face-saving situation whereby neither the United States wants to see another Cancun and can't afford to, with an election coming up, and then on the other hand, Brazil can't afford to really see itself as the bad guy again and being hammered. So they have come to some kind of a compromise, and with the text that I have in front of me is the final declaration that will probably be coming out of the meetings on Friday. And essentially, it's a document that really is designed to give the impression that it's business as usual, that we're on the move, we're on the march, that we're putting this stuff back together again in a little bit different way, but essentially we're moving ahead, and which in many ways, I mean, it does not at all reflect the fundamental shift that's taken place as a result of the kind of events that have occurred in the last few months. So, as a result, what's happened is that you've got a document that is designed to spin a certain message out there that things are back on track and things are moving, and when in fact, in many ways, I think that they're faced with a situation where they're almost back at the starting gate again, and are having to put this back together again in a new way.
Let me ask you, the FTAA has gotten very little coverage here in the United States. What is the, in the Canadian press, what has been the coverage in relationship to the virtual collapse of the whole idea?
Well, in Canada, there's been, I mean, it's almost the same as the U.S. now. We do not have press that or media that really covers the inside and outside story in the way that we used to see a bit of that happening. And as a result, we do not have the kind of public awareness and public debate in our country as well about these same issues. So in that sense, we are in a similar situation as you are here in the U.S.
So finally, now you have Robert Zoellick, the trade representative from the United States, meeting to try to exact these bilateral agreements, unable to get the full free trade area of the Americas agreement in the form that they want?
Exactly. I mean, if we go back to the origins of this, they put this free trade area of the America plan together immediately following the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, coming into being. It was built on that euphoria. It was built on that sense that this is the drive now. We're going to go throughout the Americas, and we're going to have NAFTA on steroids. We're going to have a comprehensive free trade area of the Americas with all the built-in disciplines and with all the Chapter 11s that allow corporations to sue governments directly. All of that was going to be put in place here. And that was the U.S. agenda, and it was the Canadian agenda. It wasn't just the U.S., it was the Canadian agenda as well to push this. And what's happened is that has fallen apart in the sense that we the subject matters are all there still, but the way of going about this now is not going to be what they call a top-down comprehensive agreement where all the players are expected to follow, you know, a whole set of obligations. There will be obligations built into this, but it'll be much more bottom-up in the sense that countries can opt in and opt out. And that's what's going to make it really, really difficult. This is not the same agenda, the same model, and the same FTAA that the U.S., backed up by Canada, originally pushed.
Tony Clark, thanks for being with us, director of the Polaris Institute in Canada and the Council of Canadians, speaking to us from Miami, where major protests are planned for today and tomorrow against the free trade area of the Americas. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to the Federal Commission investigating the September 11th attacks, which met yesterday in New Jersey, held a public hearing, its fifth. The meeting came 1 week after the commission reached a controversial agreement to see some classified pre-911 White House briefings. Some members of the independent commission investigating have blasted the conditions that the White House has set in order for members of the commission to examine documents related to the attacks. Former Senator Max Cleland said, "If this decision stands, I, as a member of the commission, cannot look any American in the eye, especially family members of victims, and say the commission had full access. This investigation is now compromised," he said. The Washington Post reports the White House has agreed to allow four members of the 10-person committee have varying degrees of access to the classified presidential briefings. Restrictions will be placed on what briefings can be seen and on what portions of the briefings may be shared with the rest of the commission. The White House is also demanding it review any notes that commissioners take concerning the documents. Just before the program, we reached Commissioner Timothy Romer. This is what he had to say.
I believe that when you are an independent commission, who we are really supposed to be accountable to the American people, not the Clinton administration, not the Bush administration, but the American people for why 3,000 people died on September the 11th, 2001. How did these terrorists, these snakes, crawl through the cracks, exploit our system, take advantage of mistakes and errors and gaps in our system in the intelligence community, maybe in the policy community, and exploit that so that they could take advantage of one of the most devastating attacks ever on our homeland? It seems to me that we need to be absolutely in the sunshine on this. We need to be accountable to the American people. We need to follow all the facts wherever they lead. And we should not be agreeing to restrictions, constraints, and limitations, particularly with the White House, who we're looking at and investigating, as to how much of a presidential daily brief is available to us. We should get the whole presidential daily brief, not just pieces or articles of it. The entire 10 commissioners should see it, not one or two or three or four. Having written the legislation to create the 9/11 Commission with Senators McCain and Lieberman, we did not contemplate little committees or little subgroups of the commission getting certain access to specific documents and not letting other members get that. Finally, we did not ever contemplate nor imagine that the White House would ultimately be able to decide if more commissioners could see certain documents or to the degree that the independent commission would let some outside entity decide who would get access to some of the most important documents we can see. These documents can hopefully answer two questions. One, what did Presidents Clinton and Bush know in terms of warning prior to attacks, either in the embassies in Africa or in New York and the Pentagon on 9/11? And two, and as importantly, what did the intelligence community do to inform the top policymakers through these PDBs? Did they drop the ball and not do the job? Did they fail to put the sufficient warnings in the robust context in these PDBs to let policymakers know what was going to happen? So they are two fundamentally important questions. We should not have our hands tied. We should have sunshine on this agreement, and we should make sure that we're accountable not to the White House but to the American people.
And that was Timothy Romer, one of the commissioners in the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States, the independent commission investigating the September 11th attacks. You are listening to Democracy Now! In our studio, we are joined by Peter Lantz, a five-time Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter, former ABC News correspondent. His latest book is Thousand Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story. We're also joined by Monica Gabrielle. She's the wife of Richard Gabrielle, who was killed on September 11th at the World Trade Center. She was among the witnesses at yesterday's hearing at Drew University. Juan?
And Monica, given that it got so little coverage, could you tell us a little bit about what you said?
The hearing yesterday was mainly focused on evacuation and emergency preparedness, which was sorely lacking on 9/11. My testimony encompassed all the failures over the course of the life of the World Trade Center and towers and the changes they could have made to prevent the huge loss of life on September 11th, and the issues relating to codes and such going forward. Hopefully in the new year, the more hard-hitting hearings are scheduled, where they will bring in the key players in New York to find out exactly what they knew, when they knew it, and what they did about it.
Where did your husband?
You know, the building collapsed and crushed them all before they could get out to safety.
How did you know?
There were survivors that were with him on the floor that did make it out, that had minor injuries, and subsequently have learned that the fire service, Fire Marshal Ronnie Buca, which Peter mentions in his book, and Oreo Palmer had both made it to the 78th floor, where no one had thought anyone had made it that high, and were in the process of evacuating the injured. So there was a clear indication that had the building stood longer, at least a great many of them would have survived.
What about the questions you have? Can you enumerate some of them, your greatest concerns right now?
On the national or the local level? Because there are two issues here.
We'll start with the national.
The national, as Tim Romer said, we are very concerned about the unfettered access by this commission to all key documents and supporting notes and meeting notes and list of attendees to different briefings, especially with the White House and the daily briefings from the intelligence community. This commission was handpicked. We are not asking for this information to be distributed to the public or the media.
Handpicked by
the White House, and they all have clearance. Tim Romer served on the joint inquiry.
That was a
congressional investigation, which was, only got so far. They had not had access to these documents, so he's definitely had clearance and been involved in all kinds of reviews of the information. Mr. Lehman is former Navy intelligence. I mean, they've all got their own expertise, and all 10 should have access to this information and be able to look at it with different eyes to see, what is important, what was filtered up, what didn't reach, and what didn't get.
Some of the suggestions that I've been seeing from unnamed, obviously, administration sources is that there's a concern about the presidential daily briefings having information on other activities other than 9/11 that would be a particular concern to get out. And I would like to ask Peter Lantz what you think about that.
Well, the particular the PDB of August 6th is crucial.
PDB means
Presidential Daily Briefing. 5 weeks before 9/11, it's believed that it was labeled Bin Laden determined to attack the United States as a report that there was a British intelligence report suggesting there might be a plot to hijack a plane to free blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who, in my book, I chronicle, is at the heart of, from 1989 all the way through 9/11 is the heart of Bin Laden's crusade. This is the Warrant Commission of our day.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because in the indictment of Lynn Stewart, Ashcroft specifically states that the attack on the USS Cole was in direct response to demand to free the Sheikh.
Absolutely. 2 weeks before the Cole bombing, the fatwa where Bin Laden had the dagger, he had the Sheikh's son, said, go to the spilling of blood for your Sheikh. Remember El Sayed Nasser. It goes back to 1989, as I point out in my book. But for the time we have here, look, this is the Warren Commission of our day. 40 years after the Kennedy assassination, people still have grave doubts about whether that was a thorough investigation. The idea that the White House in any way would restrict access to the material pertinent to the greatest unsolved mass murder in U.S. history is reprehensible. The White House fought the joint inquiry being created by Congress. The White House stonewalled for months to fight the joint commission, the 9/11 commission being created. Monica is a member of the Family Steering Committee. These courageous 9/11 widows who are literally making democracy work by putting the fire to the feet of these commissioners and the White House. Why is it that a group of 10 women, widows in New Jersey and New York area are having to fight for full disclosure when, in fact, you know, this pertains directly to the U.S., security of the U.S. and the next attack? If we don't learn what intelligence failures led to 9/11, we're not going to be prepared for the next one. So it's directly related to U.S. security, and they're stonewalling at every turn in the White House.
I want to go back to this PDB, Presidential Daily Briefing, because not a lot of people know about this one 5 weeks before the September 11th attacks.
Right.
Can you specifically say who did the briefing, what information they had?
Well, it's prepared essentially. Condi Rice was involved in the preparation of it. The briefing apparently resides with the CIA at this point, but these are briefings that presidents get on a regular basis. President Clinton has made it clear that all of his presidential papers without restriction will be turned over to the commission. There are no restrictions on the 8 years of the Clinton presidency, on which there was tremendous negligence with respect to al-Qaeda. But President Clinton has already said full disclosure. What does this White House have to hide? Philip Zelikow was appointed as the staff director of this commission. He and Condi Rice wrote their last book together. He was on the National Security Council. These committee members asked that Philip Zelikow be recused, but be removed from the commission as the staff director. And they said, no, we'll just recuse him from the issues that relate to the NSC. I mean, how could they remove the issues relating to the NSC, where they could go to the heart of the negligence of the Bush administration?
Peter Lance, we have to break. Peter Lance has written the book 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story. Monica Gabriel lost her husband, Richard, the World Trade Center on September 11th. She is demanding information and justice. Stay with us.
Tell you the story, all good friends of mine, of the heroes and survivors of a terrible time. Two great people separated by the sea, joined in understanding of a great calamity, of a great calamity. 1831, it was the darkest of their years. Colonel Jackson drove the Choctaw on the Trail of Tears with the saber and the rifle. On a 1,000-mile drive to the land of Oklahoma, only half would survive, only half would survive. They called it a reservation. It was a cage without a wire. What 100 years later the Germans would admire, surrounded by a state that held the lock and key to the vision of their future and their free humanity, well, their free humanity.
Heroes and Survivors, Jim Page, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue with our conversation with Peter Lance, author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story, as well as Monica Gabriel, lost her husband Richard Gabriel at the World Trade Center and testified yesterday at a little covered hearing at Drew University, the hearing of the Independent Commission investigating the 9/11 attacks. Juan?
Well, Peter, I'd like to continue where we left off. In terms of the ability of the Bush administration to continue to hold back these briefing papers in particular, the commission has a deadline of, is it May of next year?
Yeah, here's the problem, Juan. Congress set the deadline where they have, by May 27th, they have to issue their report. So they're up against this timeline, and the Bush administration exploited that by delaying and delaying. In July, they issued a preliminary report saying they were being stonewalled by the Pentagon and the Justice Department on access to witnesses, et cetera. So last week, when Richard Benvenista, one of the heroes of Watergate, went along, a Democrat, went along with this compromise, he said, well, we have to do it because we're under tremendous time pressure. What's the time pressure, guys? Extend the investigation another 8 months. It's only funded at $14 million compared to $50 million for the Columbia space shuttle investigation where 8 people died. Where are the priorities here? When President Kennedy died, it did not relate to American security, really. It was a tragic death of an individual president. What happened on 9/11, which this commission is seeking to find out why it happened, relates directly to our national security. So if it takes 2 years, fund it for $100 million, take a piece of that $87 billion being spent in Iraq and put it on the 9/11 commission and let these people get to the truth. Otherwise, for decades, people will be doubting. Tom Keene, nobody's going to remember he was Republican governor of New Jersey in 50 years. They're going to remember whether Tom Keene, you know, put this administration to the test and got full disclosure.
Well, specifically on Keene, obviously the president wanted Kissinger initially, right?
Right, of course.
To head the commission.
Yeah, and that lasted a week and a half.
So, but now you've got a situation where Keene at least seems to have to be attempting to buck the administration, but you feel he caved in.
Seems to be attempting, but they caved in. It was an absolute cave-in, and so did Richard Benvenista, so did the Democrats. Tim Romer and Max Cleland, to me, as a journalist, looking at this, are the only members who are aggressive on this panel so far. Monica can speak. She's closer to it. And the fact that Monica and the widows are actually doing more in an aggressive way than the mass media or anybody to make sure the commission stays honest.
So what are you calling for right now, Monica?
We're hoping for a revisit to the agreement and have access to all, you know, for all the commissioners. I think it's crucial that they all have unfettered access and are able to look at all the documents relating to 9/11.
Can you explain what these documents say? That what is it? The agreement is that only four commissioners of the 10-member committee have varying degrees of access.
Yeah, in other words, instead of like having them go into a secure room, which they do all the time, and look at the presidential daily briefing and see what it actually says, they're going to have two people look at the briefings, then they're going to write up a report, then the White House is going to edit the notes of their report, and then they're going to share it with the four people who are then going to go back and share it with the 10 people. Why not just have all these people who have this level of security clearance go in?
All right, well, that's the question. Why not? Peter Lance, you have done a many hundred-page book on this issue.
Right.
Not just the White House doesn't want the information to get out, but specifically, what do you think are the most damaging information that this commission could see?
Well, in my book, in the second-to-last chapter, chronicle the year 2000, how many dots in the chart, how many warnings there were to the Bush administration of an imminent attack by al-Qaeda on the U.S. I think they were, at a minimum, they were negligent with respect to preventing the attacks. At a minimum. And so therefore, I don't think in an election year they want the American. They invaded a country where they gave false information with respect to weapons of mass destruction and the connection of al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein. We're now in that protracted guerrilla war, right? If the American people see, and if it's true that they were negligent on failing to prevent 9/11, that could cost George Bush the White House. He doesn't want this information to come out. I mean, it's a no-brainer to figure out why they would want to hold it back.
Well, let me just say this. 3,000 people are dead. We already know there are failures across the board. We have a pretty good indication of what those failures are. And this commission is supposed to set up recommendations going forward. You cannot give clear recommendations unless you see exactly where the breakdown was. Was the breakdown in the information coming to the president, or was it in the breakdown filtering up to him, or was it in his perception of what these briefings were? Until we know that, we are still a country at risk. And this is not for the American people. We don't want this disclosed to everyone. They're claiming national security, and we're well aware of that. But these commissioners have clearance. They are responsible for getting to the facts and the truth and making the changes.
Well, let me ask you, the listeners and viewers of Democracy Now! Are a pretty active bunch of people around the country. If you wanted to urge them to do something to assist in this effort, what would you urge them to do?
Right. Call.
To who?
The website is 9-11-commission.gov. 9-11-commission.gov. Flood them with emails, demand that they extend the investigation, get it properly funded by, if they have to go back to Congress, who cares? You know, the American people ought to have the truth. We should not have this be the Warren Commission of our day.
The other investigation, the congressional investigation,
severely flawed,
where George Bush was able to
redact
28 pages. Right. How does that affect this investigation? And what about the significance of those 28 pages?
That investigation was severely limited to begin with.
Why?
They only covered certain parts of the executive branch. A number of witnesses were never called. And you saw the ultimate, and the Bush administration fought the release of the report, 850, and even then it was heavily redacted. They focused on the, and when the horse was way out of the barn, they focused primarily on post-1998, 99 to 2001. What my book shows is that this thing started under the presidency of the president's father in 1989 is when the road to 9/11 began. There's a direct line all the way up through 9/11. So the question is, what is this? Does this administration specifically have to hide? If President Clinton, why can't President Bush agree to do what President Clinton has done? Full disclosure. Under top secret.
And that 28 pages, what it said, what your understanding as an investigative reporter who's been looking at this issue?
We don't know. I don't have any understanding.
It
supposedly relates to the Saudis, but, you know, we don't know, and we should know in order to make intelligent choices.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been joined by Peter Lance, 5-time Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter, former ABC News correspondent. His book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story. And you can go to our website, democracynow.org, put in Peter Lance's name, and you can listen to or watch the full hour we had with him in a debate about the what happened around 9/11 and the investigations there. Monica Gabriel, wife of Richard Gabriel, who killed at the World Trade Center. We thank them both for being with us. As we move now to our last segment of the program, the government filed fresh charges yesterday against New York civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. She's accused of providing assistance to imprisoned radical Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. The charges were announced yesterday by Attorney General John Ashcroft, brought against Stewart and two alleged co-conspirators, postal worker Ahmed Sattar and translator Mohammed Yusri. The new superseding indictments comes after a federal judge in July dismissed charges that the three had conspired to provide material support to Abdulrahman's Islamic group, which is designated as a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. Judge John Kuttle said the original charges were unconstitutionally vague and, quote, reveal a lack of prosecutorial standards.
Prosecutors had accused Stewart of passing messages between her client, Abdulrahman, and an Egyptian terrorist organization. Rahman was convicted of conspiring to blow up several New York landmarks and to assassinate Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. He is serving a life sentence. The new indictment describes a series of acts committed by Stewart, one of which charges that during a May 2000 prison visit with Abdulrahman, Stewart, quote, pretended to be participating in the conversation with Abdulrahman by making extraneous comments such as, quote, chocolate and heart attack. She faces a maximum jail sentence ranging from 5 years to 15 years.
We are joined in the studio right now by human rights attorney Lynn Stewart. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. And although the government characterized the maximum time as 5 to 15, conceivably it could be 45 or 50 if they decided to pile the charges on.
Can you explain what a superseding indictment is?
Surely. We knew they had to supersede, that is, vote a new indictment, because their old indictment was flawed. First of all, the judge had dismissed two charges, and secondly, they had times and dates, and things were mixed up in it. But they took another 7 months, during which time they flirted with going up on appeal on the judge's ruling, and then decided not to go up on appeal, and now, a month before a trial is supposed to begin, they have now come down with this new superseding, that is, replacing the old indictment, reinstating the charges, in my view, that the judge decided were void for vagueness under this law.
So there was a grand jury that was impaneled over the last weeks where a number of people have been called up to testify?
That's what we understand, yes. But there actually is very little that's new in this indictment. This does seem to be reworked. The old press release is right in there. That still forms the gravamen of my communication on behalf of my client. My client, Sheikh Omar, is now characterized as, quote, personnel, and that I provided personnel to a terrorist organization by making this press release. It's a little hard to construct all of this because also in that law is implicit that it's secret, that I held him secretly and provided secret personnel to the organization. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand how complicated and how complex they have had to get to change this so that they hope they will meet the judge's standards.
And in the in the material that I saw on the release on the indictment yesterday, they were saying that, that for instance, again, what I had mentioned in the earlier segment, that supposedly you were involved in facilitating the conspiracy between the Sheikh and your other co-defendant in terms of the battleship Cole attack, the USS Cole attack.
Yes, the first 15 pages of this indictment, and it runs to almost 25 pages, are replete with just about every terrorist incident that has occurred since 9/11 and actually even before that. A part of it is lifted directly from my co-defendant's dissertation, which dealt with the Sheikh. Given all of that...
This is the translator, Mohammed Yousri.
This is Mohammed Yousri's, yes, his dissertation.
And he was at NYU, and he...
He was at NYU. He was a doctoral candidate. His subject was Sheikh Omar.
And he was your translator when you would communicate with him at the prison.
He was our translator. He was the only one the government would approve, interestingly. Interestingly enough. But at any rate, they did certainly waved the flag over the first 15 pages. They apparently based the reference to the Cole upon some news that they had gotten that an Egyptian was involved, and then on a telephone conversation with Ahmed Sattar. Now, we can't comment on what is in these tapes. I can only say that the heart attack and chocolate had to do with me saying to the Sheikh, who was eating M&Ms, I said, "You're going to cause yourself a heart attack eating all that chocolate." And, of course, this now becomes a code for something or other by this very, very paranoid government under which we live.
We only have 30 seconds on Stuart. What do you do now?
We fight on. We are valiant in the defense of the Constitution because this still remains an attack on the Sixth Amendment, the right to counsel, and particularly the right to counsel for those persons we consider to be political prisoners.
The press release they're referring to?
Was a press release made by me in June, actually, of 2000, indicating that the Sheikh wanted a reconsideration of a ceasefire that his group had agreed to with Mubarak. Mubarak, who is a sponsor of state terrorism against his own people, was the focus of that, and this was nothing to do with sending messages. It was released to Reuters. It was no secret at all.
Lynn Stuart, we will continue to follow your case. Again, has been indicted once again by John Ashcroft's Justice Department, a superseding indictment after a judge dropped the two major terrorism charges against her. That does it for the program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. Looking forward to being at UC Berkeley tonight for the Mario Savio Lecture. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
of a great calamity.